Had Ireland been a perfect creation, I don't think Yeats's poetry would have been much to write home about. It was the fact that Ireland both inspired him, frustrated him, bewildered him, and angered him. And yet, he never lost his interest in the country. It's that combination that I believe makes Yeats the great Irish poet that I believe he is.
That was the voice of Dan Mulhall, historian, author, and former Irish ambassador to the United States. I'm Martin Nutty, and you're listening to an Irish Stew podcast check-in episode. We last hosted Dan on the podcast in March of 2022, when he was winding down a 44-year career in the Irish Diplomatic Corps, culminating with his final posting as Irish ambassador to Washington, D.C. In that centenary year for James Joyce's Ulysses, Dan had written a book revealing his thoughts on Dublin's greatest novel, which we happily explored, along with stories from his diplomatic career. Now Dan is back to talk with us about his latest book, Pilgrim's Soul, W.B. Yeats and the Ireland of His Time, which is published by New Island Books. I'll be talking with Dan about his busy retirement from the Department of Foreign Affairs and, of course, Ireland's first Nobeliate, the enigmatic William Butler Yeats, regarded by many as the greatest poet of the 20th century. We're releasing this episode on Sunday, January 28th, which marks the day of Yeats's passing in the south of France 85 years ago. And now, a word from our sponsor.
This episode is sponsored by Shantella, your all-in-one business launchpad in the United States. Committed to excellence in execution, Shantella helps enterprises enter or expand in the U.S. market through bespoke project management and strategic planning solutions. Create and realize your vision with Shantella, where they invest their passion in your future success. To learn more, go to Shantella.space. Yes, .space. It's a thing.
So, Dan, the last time we had you on the podcast was back in 2022, and you just published a book about Joyce. Much has changed in your life since then. You spent 44 years, I believe, in the Department of Foreign Affairs, but the globetrotting seems to have continued despite all that. So tell us about the learnings of the transition. I believe you did a semester as a professor of Irish literature in NYU at Glucksmann's House, and then went on to the Parnell Fellowship at Cambridge. So give us some insights on the past years.
I suppose, Martin, for the few years before I could see that I was approaching, you know, the retirement date, and I knew that I was coming to the end of my five-year tenure in Washington, D.C., and 44 years, as you say, in the Department of Foreign Affairs, I suppose America taught me a lesson, which is that retirement doesn't have to be a full stop. It can be more like a semicolon with another few chapters to run after that, because many of the people I met in Washington and around the United States were older than I was, and yet they were still active in various walks of life. Well, they had changed maybe the rhythm of their work. So I was keen not to go off the cliff face and not to suddenly go from working 24/7 to getting up in the morning wondering what to do next. So I was offered an opportunity to teach at NYU at Glucksmann Ireland House. I was the Global Distinguished Professor of Irish Studies there and really enjoyed my semester there. Living in the village was a great treat. I had never lived in New York before. I'd been there obviously many, many times on business and as a tourist from time to time. But living there was a genuine treat, and Greta and I got to see more or less all of New York. We took full advantage of our 4 months at NYU to see all the places in New York that we hadn't seen on our many visits. Most of my previous visits had been as ambassador, and obviously I was very busy. I had full programs, and there wasn't much time to do anything other than the official business that I was there to do. After that, I went to Magdalen College in Cambridge. And Magdalen College in Cambridge is a strong Irish connection. Charles Stuart Parnell was a student there in the 1860s. And about 30 years ago, a graduate of the college endowed an annual Parnell Fellowship in memory of Charles Stuart Parnell. And I was fortunate enough to be offered that fellowship for 2022-2023. So I spent a number of months at Magdalen College, which is mainly where I wrote the book that I've just published, Pilgrim Soul, WBS and the Ireland of His Time, because I wasn't actually teaching at Cambridge. I had more time to do reading and research and writing. And then finally, for the fall semester of last year, of 2023, I joined the Institute of Politics at Harvard University, at the Harvard Kennedy School. The Institute of Politics is a program within the Harvard Kennedy School, which is aimed at postgraduates, and it's aimed to give them leadership skills and knowledge that they wouldn't maybe get in the course of their academic studies. So I had 3 months at Harvard as one of the visiting fellows at the Institute of Politics, and I had some very, very bright students there. I really enjoyed the experience of connecting with those students and giving them some idea about what the life of a diplomat like myself has been, and about European Union affairs, and indeed about Northern Ireland, which I also talked extensively about while I was at Harvard. And now I'm back in Europe, and I'm living between Scotland and Ireland, and enjoying a slightly less frenetic lifestyle than the one I had as ambassador for so many years, but also keeping myself quite busy doing various projects, including, of course, promoting my book, Pilgrim Soul, W.B. Yeats and the Ireland of His Time.
So it was interesting when you were talking about your experience over the past year that you referred to Parnell, and I got to start talking about Pilgrim Soul by talking about Parnell, because in reading your book, one of the things that revealed to me was the extraordinary complexity and almost ornery quality about Yeats. And I know that Yeats seems to have been rather fond of Parnell in opposition to his family. And it seems to me much of Yeats's life was being in opposition to certain things.
Yeah.
So would you consider him to be an ornery guy? And talk to me a little bit about Parnell and Yeats and Irish nationalism, because that seemed to go against maybe the Yeats family. Would that be fair?
Well, some elements of the Yeats family, yes. Although I would say that Yeats's father was a home rule nationalist. He was someone who was in favor of home rule. He came from a Protestant background. Yeats's grandfather and many members of his family, the generations before, were actually Church of Ireland clergymen. And then on his mother's side, he was part of a family that were in business. They were an Anglo-Irish family in business in Sligo, quite a wealthy, successful merchant family, the Plexfans in Sligo. So with that background, you might not have expected Yeats to be an ideal candidate to be the greatest poet of nationalist Ireland, if you like. But that is how Yeats's life turned out. And it's one of the great paradoxes. The easy option for Yeats, say he was born in 1865. So by 1885, he was 20 years of age. And he had obviously got literary talent. There's no question about that. Even you can see from his early poems, the first poems he wrote, that he had some kind of pretty amazing literary talent. Now, the commercially sensible thing to do would have been to follow in the footsteps of George Bernard Shaw and Oscar Wilde, and go to London and be a sort of a slightly exotic Irish writer within the English language mainstream, which is what both Wilde and Shaw were, okay? And before him, of course, other people did that. Goldsmith did it, Sheridan did it, Burke did it, Swift. It was back and forth between Britain and Ireland, but probably wanted to be more of a mainstream English writer and was a bit miffed that he ended up having to spend much of his life in Ireland. So Yeats had a choice. And in fact, the family had lived in London for quite a while. Yeats himself spent a very large percentage of his life living in London. And yet he decided that he was going to be an Irish writer who would write about Irish topics and try to relate to an Irish audience. So that was a key decision that Yeats made in the 1880s. Yeats really didn't know Parnell hardly at all, because Yeats was only 25 years of age when Parnell died. Now, he did write a poem about Parnell's death, which he wasn't that proud of, because it was a bit of doggerel, really, that he wrote. And obviously, it was popular at the time and got published in the Nationalist Press that were favorably disposed towards Parnell. But the key thing about Yeats and Parnell is that Parnell lived on in Yeats's mind. Parnell never left Yeats's imagination. So in the late 1930s, when Parnell was dead almost 50 years, Yeats was still writing poems about him. And that's because Parnell came to be seen by Yeats as the epitome of the Anglo-Irish tradition in politics and literature, which Yeats embraced strongly during the 1920s and 30s, largely because he was disenchanted with the realities of independence in the Irish Free State.
So in your book, you refer to Yeats's indomitable Irishry.
Yes.
And in thinking about that phrase, I wondered about the whole arc of how Yeats has been seen since the independence of the state, because Ireland becomes independent in the 1920s, and it evolves into, in my view, a very Catholic state.
Yes.
And Irish identity seemed very bound with Catholicism. And Yeats is an Anglo-Irish man, and in many Irish minds, let's say in the first 50 years of Irish independence, Anglo-Irish people really weren't Irish. But yet Yeats sees himself very much as an Irish man. Can you talk a little bit about how Yeats has been, and it's a big ask, seen since the independence of the state and now, and how that's evolved?
Well, of course, there the obvious comparisons with James Joyce. Now, during his lifetime, James Joyce was a scandalous figure that nobody in Ireland would have wanted much to do with, or certainly nobody in official Ireland, nobody in any kind of position of authority. He had some fans, of course, but he also had a lot of fairly sharp detractors. And actually, when you think about it, Joyce left Ireland in 1904. And for the next 37 years of his life, he only came back to Ireland a couple of times. His last visit to Ireland was in 1910. So while Joyce focused on the Ireland he left behind and wrote this extraordinary novel, Ulysses, about that Ireland, he didn't seem to have that much interest in the Ireland that developed after his departure. Whereas in the case of Yeats, and of course, Joyce is still buried in Zurich, and there's no suggestion that Joyce's body will ever be transferred back to Ireland. Yeats, on the other hand, was involved with Irish public life from the 1880s till the late 1930s. So, for example, as early as 1888, when Yeats was 23 years old, his poems appeared in an anthology dedicated to the Fenian John O'Leary, with whom Yeats was closely connected. And that was called The Poems of Young Ireland. And that was a deliberate attempt on the part of Yeats's generation of young Irish writers to connect themselves with the tradition of young Ireland of the 1840s, of Thomas Davis and Charles Gavan Duffy and all those poets and writers who flourished during the 1840s. And then many of them ended up in the United States, including Thomas Francis Marr, who became the commander of the Irish Brigade during the Civil War. So Yeats, from a very early age, decided that he wanted to be involved in Irish affairs. And let me just take you through a short history of Yeats's engagement with Ireland. When Parnell died in 1891, the country went into a bit of a, it was almost a bit like the assassination of John F. Kennedy in the 60s in America. There was a great sort of despondency developed. And Joyce's father, for example, who was a great supporter and admirer of Parnell, never did anything useful in his life after Parnell's death. He seemed to go downhill. And I think that whole generation suffered a terrible traumatic loss with the loss of this charismatic leader who promised to so much and then unfortunately came to grief because of problems in his personal life. So immediately after Parnell's death, Yeats started to argue that we needed to have a national literature for Ireland in the English language. He proceeded to set up the Irish Literary Society in 1892 in London. That society still exists to this very day. He then set up the National Literary Society in Dublin. And at the National Literary Society in 1893, a year after it was founded, Douglas Hyde, who later became the first president of Ireland, made a speech which led to the foundation of the Gaelic League and the effort to revive the Irish language, which captured the attention of young men like Patrick Pearse and Thomas MacDonagh and Joseph Mary Plunkett, who ended up, and Eamon De Valera, who became active in public life initially through their membership of the Gaelic League and eventually ended up fighting in the Rising of 1916. Yeats then in the 1890s was very active in all sorts of nationalistic activities, some of which were driven by his interest in Maud Gonne, who was his love interest and a fervent nationalist of a much more radical strand than Yeats. But nonetheless, she drew Yeats further and further into that area of Irish politics. And for example, in 1898, Yeats became the president of the Centenary Association set up to commemorate the rebellion of 1798, right? In 1900, he became a supporter of the Boer cause during the Boer War, and he took part in pro-Boer activities in Dublin. He opposed the visit to Ireland in 1900 of Queen Victoria. He wrote public letters condemning the Queen's visit. In 1903, he opposed the visit of King Edward VII to Ireland. So he had what I would call very strong nationalist pedigree from the mid-1880s to the early part of the 20th century. And that came to a peak in 1903 when a play was produced in Dublin at the precursor to the Abbey Theatre called Kathleen Ni Houlihan. And that was the most nationalistic play probably written in 19th, 20th century Ireland, right? It was a play that was fervently nationalistic, the most nationalistic thing that Yeats ever wrote. It's almost like a piece of propaganda about this old lady who wanted to get back her four green fields from the foreigners who'd come and taken her fields away from her. I mean, you couldn't get more nationalist Republican ethos than that. He wrote that play with Lady Gregory, who was an aristocrat from County Galway, but who became also a fervent nationalist. So, and then he set up the Abbey Theatre in 1904. The Abbey Theatre is still, to this day, our national theatre. After 1905, he started to become disenchanted with Ireland. And by 1913, he'd become deeply disaffected. And he wrote this famous poem called September 1913, which bemoaned the fact and said, "Romantic Ireland's dead and gone. It's with O'Leary in the grave." John O'Leary had died a few years earlier, and Yeats saw O'Leary's death as the death of romantic Ireland, by which he meant the kind of Ireland that he aspired to create as a young man in the 1890s and the early part of the 20th century. And then the Easter Rising came and revived Yeats's interest in Ireland. You had that great poem, which I think is one of the greatest public poems of the 20th century, Easter 1916. "We know their dream enough to know they dreamed and are dead. And what of excessive love bewildered them till they died? I write it out in a verse, MacDonagh and MacBride, Connolly and Pierce, now and in time to be, wherever green is worn, are changed utterly, a terrible beauty is born." And that, of course, is not a piece of cheerleading for the Easter Rising. It's a very ambivalent poem because he asked the question, was it needless death after all? For England may keep faith for all that is done and said. So he, in that poem also, raises the revisionist thesis that maybe the Easter Rising wasn't necessary after all. And then in the 1920s, Yeats returns to Ireland in the late teens and is in Ireland for much of the War of Independence and the Civil War, at considerable risk to himself because he was associated with the pro-treaty side in the Civil War and could have been a target for Republicans. And yet he lived in a place where the Civil War was raging, in County Galway, when he lived in his tower at Ballylee in County Galway near the home of Lady Gregory. So his commitment to Ireland, I think, was undoubted. He was a strongly committed Irishman. His view of Irish nationalism wouldn't have appealed to every taste in Ireland, but I think looking back, there was no doubt but that Yeats was a patriotic Irishman devoted to the cause of Irish independence. And the very fact that he spent the last 20 years of his life mainly living in Ireland, a country that was struggling to make its way in the world after the War of Independence and a damaging civil war in 1922-23.
It's an extraordinary story. It seems to me there may have been far easier lives that Yeats could have lived. And of course, we know his economic situation, I don't think, was ever great. Certainly, no. The circumstances of his family, his father, who was a talented painter, but could never seem to have any economic sense whatsoever. But you refer to the fact at the death of Parnell, where you have these two emerging things happening. Yeats has decided he's going to really push to create some great Anglo-Irish literature, and you've got Douglas Hyde on the other side doing, hey, we need to get this language up and running, and we're going to do the Gaelic League thing. Now, you've written a book about Joyce. You've written a book about Yeats. What do you make of the fact that neither of these men ever made, in my view, a significant effort to learn the language of their native island? So Joyce, for example, we know was a polyglot. He learned Norwegian so he could read Ibsen, right? So Joyce certainly had the capability to learn multiple languages. Yeats is not so clear to me, but maybe you can throw some light on that.
Well, Yeats was apparently very poor at languages. He did try to learn French. He spent a lot of time in France over the years with Maud gone, and did try to pick up French, but never managed to make any headway with it. So his attitude to Irish was he thought that Gaelic Ireland, the Gaelic tradition was wonderful, but he was happy to access it through the English language and translation. He didn't feel a need himself to delve into the Irish language. And I don't think he would have made a good fist of it anyway because of his lack of facility for learning languages. But I mean, he did, of course, associate with Hyde. They would have known each other. I mean, Yeats was ambivalent about Hyde, but he certainly recognized that Hyde was a man who had done something quite extraordinary by being able to immerse himself in the way he did in the folklore and the literature of Gaelic Ireland. And of course, Lady Gregory, his great collaborator, she spoke Irish very well. And she was able, I think, to give Yeats access to the local people in the Cool area who would at that time would have been Irish speakers. And likewise, John Millington Synge was another one whom Yeats was close to, who also benefited from his knowledge of Irish. So Yeats would have had people around him who were Irish speakers, would have realized that the Gaelic League was doing important work. But what his basic argument was that we can have a literature that is Gaelic in spirit, but written in the English language. I don't think he discounted that there could be a literature in Irish as well. But what he did resist was the idea that you could only have an Irish literature in the Irish language. That was something he couldn't accept. And that was where he was sharply criticized by some nationalists who believed that Yeats's nationalism was corrupted by his lack of interest in the Irish language.
So that kind of boomerangs me back again to the foundation of the state. You made a very persuasive case as to the unquestionable Irishness of Yeats. I think the facts speak for that, and you're very persuasive along those lines. But for certain types, I think, of people in Ireland, the foundation of the state, if you weren't Catholic, if you didn't master the Irish language, if you saw yourself as being Anglo-Irish, you weren't really Irish. So did that lean in on Yeats, or was he just such a strong personality that he didn't really care? Because you see him at war. There's an angry Yeats that comes out through your book. He's at war with the middle class. He's at war with the Catholic Church. Yep. He's at war with the controversy over the funding of the Hugh Lane Gallery. He's a guy that seems at odds with the country that he is living in late in his life.
Yeah, I think again there you come back to the contrast between Yeats and Joyce, because Yeats was always attracted, I think, by an ideal Ireland, by an Ireland that maybe had existed in centuries gone by. Remember, in one of his last poems under Ben Baldwin, he used the phrase, "An ancient Ireland knew it all." In other words, he had this fat view that Ireland was this great civilization that had been eroded over the years. And I think he probably blamed the Catholic Church for a lot of that erosion. By the time the 1920s came around, Yeats was, I think, disturbed by what he saw as the kind of narrowness of what he would have viewed as Catholic nationalism. And he developed his own antidote to that point of view. And that was to idealize and lionize the Anglo-Irish tradition in Ireland, right? You see, in the 1890s, Yeats would have been quite scathing about the writers of the 18th century, had no interest in them at all. He saw them as too logical, too rational, not in any way in touch with what Yeats called mysterious powers. Yeats was always drawn by the occult and the spirit and spirit world, and Irish folklore and fairy lore and so forth. So he didn't at all care for the famous Irish writers of the 18th century, Swift, Burke, Sheridan, Goldsmith, and people like that. That was his view in the 1890s. He was also very critical of Trinity College, which was at that time the bastion of the Anglo-Irish tradition. By the time the 20s came around and Ireland became independent, remember, Yeats moved back to Ireland with his family, his English wife and family, to live in Ireland for the rest of his life. And he decided then to develop this almost a cult of the Anglo-Irish tradition. And he started to lionize Swift, Burke, Berkeley in particular. And he gave a famous speech in the Shannon, in the Senate, in the mid-20s. It was a speech which he didn't need to give. There was a motion to exclude divorce. Now, there was no proposal to have divorce, but Yeats decided anyway. There was a debate about divorce, and Yeats launched into this extraordinary, I would say, if you were to describe it politically, you would say it was not a very politic thing to do. It was a very uncompromising speech, certainly not the speech that you would give if you were trying to influence people and bring them over to your side. But he said, "We are the people of Burke, the people of Grattan, the people of Swift, the people of Berkeley, the people of Goldsmith, people of Parnell. We have created all of this country's creative greatness. We have created its political greatness," and so forth. And he said, "You have done this thing to us. You will eventually be vanquished." So he more or less declared war on Catholic Ireland on behalf of Anglo-Ireland. Now, the key thing to remember here is that most of the people who were in that chamber that day, who were themselves, because there were a lot of Anglo-Irish members of the Senate who'd been appointed by the government to give representation to the minority community at that time, they would have been appalled by this kind of carry-on by Yeats, because they wanted to keep their heads down and accommodate themselves to the new realities of the new state. But Yeats was determined to have a go and to hit back at what he saw as the excessive narrowness of Catholic nationalism. And then you go on to the 1930s, and you have another incident which I think has definitely damaged Yeats's image in Ireland. And as I say, Joyce's image has gone through the roof over the last, I'd say, 30 or 40 years, because Joyce focused on, I suppose, the nitty-gritty of the Ireland he knew, which was middle-class and maybe lower-middle-class Ireland, or Dublin in particular, in the early part of the 20th century. Yeats was much more of an idealist trying to imagine an ideal Ireland. Joyce was far more aware of the realities of the Ireland that actually existed rather than the one that he hoped, or the one that Yeats hoped he could bring into being. Yeats always felt that he had the power of poetry and the power of his imagination and his personality, that he felt he could change people's minds and create a better Ireland. Of course, that was not a realistic option. But in the early 30s, he became quite an admirer of certainly of the fascist regime in Italy under Mussolini. When he saw the emergence of an Irish fascist movement, the Blue Shirts, he had some contact with Ono Duffy, and he wrote some songs for the Blue Shirts. Now, the Blue Shirts, of course, fizzled out in less than a year. And I think Yeats was very fortunate that he fell under the spell of somebody as insignificant as Ono Duffy. So Irish fascism was, by European and international standards, a fairly tame affair. I think it was fortunate for Yeats that he dabbled in fascism in Ireland. Had he been a mainstream writer in the English language and not based in Ireland, I think he would have done more damage to himself by being attracted maybe to other strongmen around Europe. And by the way, by the mid-30s, he had turned his back completely on his previous admiration for Mussolini, in particular when the Italians invaded what was then Abyssinia, now Ethiopia. This convinced Yeats politics in Ireland. And to the end of his days, he continued to be interested in what was happening in Ireland. And in his last poems, I made the point earlier on, he wrote in his last few years, he wrote poems about Roger Casement, about Parnell, about the O'Rahilly, who was a relatively obscure participant in the Easter Rising. And he also wrote other poems about the Easter Rising. For example, asking the question in the late 30s, did a play of mine, maybe Kathleen Houlihan, may have had an influence in sowing the seeds that led to the Easter Rising of 1916 and the violence that occurred then and in the years after that event.
We could drill into, let's say, the more questionable areas of Yeats's life, but I don't think we're doing necessarily a service to his extraordinary work. And even though he was dabbling in highly questionable areas,
yes,
I think we might be better served by talking about, let's say, more pleasant aspects of his life. But you recount a very interesting story in your book about the receipt of a book during your service in India, and inscribed on the book, apparently in Yeats's hand,
yes,
is a two-line quote.
Yes.
"For wisdom is a butterfly and not a gloomy bird of prey."
Yes.
Talk to me about that quote. Talk to me about that book and what it means.
Yeah, it was one of the things I discovered in India was that a lot of people in that vast country were maybe acquainted with Ireland through our literature. I remember meeting people who had never been anywhere near Ireland, but were aware of Ireland through our history and our literature. And that was a good example, because this woman came in to see me at the embassy. She'd obviously fallen on hard times, and she offered me a number of books that her father had acquired during his time as a student at Oxford. And that one of those books included a book called Plays for an Irish Theatre, which Yeats, when he met this young Indian man, signed the book for him with two lines of verse in Yeats's hand. And that's one of my most prized possessions to this very day. But it did illustrate the appeal of Yeats that goes beyond the community of people who are either Irish or have an Irish connection, as many, many Irish Americans have. It goes beyond that to people all over the world. And I've spoken at Yeats societies in Ireland, in India, in Australia, in Korea, and in Japan. So there is a worldwide interest in the poetry of W.B. Yeats, which I think is a particular value to our country. And the one thing I would say about Yeats's unpleasant ideas, some of the unpleasant political ideas that he developed during the course of his life, those ideas didn't really intervene too much in his poetry. I think he was well able to edit out the rather weird stuff from his writing, from his poetry. Now, some of his prose and some of his letters and diaries maybe don't have that positive quality about them, but certainly in the poetry, he was a good editor of his own views, and he steered clear of some of the madder ideas. For example, if you tried to read his book, A Vision, which is based on his wife's automatic writing, which he did over a period of a number of years, it's frankly incomprehensible. But if you read The Second Coming, which is inspired by those ideas, that's a brilliant poem. And you don't have to know the ideas or to be interested in those ideas in order to really enjoy a cracking good poem, which is what The Second Coming is. And it's a poem that has reverberated down the last 100 years and is still being quoted by people to this very day. And the course I gave at Harvard last year was called If Things Fall Apart, Can the Center Hold? Which was designed to relate Yeats's poem to contemporary political dilemmas.
Yeah, it's a much quoted poem these days. I listen to David McWilliams' podcast, and he's featured it on a number of different occasions, and you see it popping up all over the place, I guess, because we are living through troubled times right now. And obviously when that poem was written in 1919, with the end of World War One, the middle of a pandemic, there are all these kind of crazy parallels. But let me just go back to the actual title of your book and then that butterfly quote, because it seems to me an apt description of who Yeats was. He was constantly evolving, constantly changing, constantly trying to figure things out and flitting from one thing to another. He was a pilgrim in a way. Of course, in the poem, he's not actually referring to himself, I believe.
No, he's referring to Morgan. But I mean, I took that poem, which I remember reading to my wife, my now wife, when I first met her. I charmed her with Yeats's poetry, and Clonard Music, I remember, was the combination I used to prove that I was an authentically romantic Irishman. But when I started writing this book, which is a few years ago now, I started many years ago, but I got a couple of chapters written and then I put it aside. When I got down to writing the book in earnest after I retired from the Department of Foreign Affairs, I realized that I couldn't write a full biography of W.B. Yeats because there's too much there. if you go down the tunnel of Yeats's interest in the occult and mysticism, you never come back. And I wasn't really interested in delving into that particular tunnel. So I gave it a wide berth. And I decided I wanted to use Pilgrim Soul as the title of the book. And I decided that I would write about Yeats's pilgrimage through the Ireland of his time. In other words, he wasn't a pilgrim soul in the religious sense, or even in the sense of the quest for love and affection is probably what motivated the poem in the first place, vis-a-vis Maud Gonne. But I was thinking more about Yeats's journey, or as I say in the book, his turris, because turris in Irish means journey and pilgrimage. So I'm using, if you like, I'm writing about Yeats's journey through the Ireland of his time, because I take the view that Yeats can illuminate aspects of Irish history that I believe are worth illuminating, because they are crucial to the Ireland that we know today. Because as I say in the book, today's Ireland is a child of the Ireland of Yeats's time, in that a lot of things have happened in the last 100 years, but nothing more fundamental than the things that happened between 1910 and 1922. So Yeats was around for the key moment in Irish history, and he chronicled that era in Irish history through a series of poems, all of which I highlight in the book, because I believe that those poems are a rich legacy that Yeats has left us. I also take the view that as time goes by and we become more remote from those years, that era, that Yeats's work as a witness to the Ireland at that time will become more and more important.
I totally agree with that, and I want to visit that a little bit more. But before we move towards that, will you indulge us with a reading of When You Were Old?
Let me tell you, first of all, the story of how I became enchanted by that poem. In 1982, I was invited by the grandmother of an Indian friend of mine to lunch at her home on a Sunday afternoon. The woman who was hosting us was a woman called Vijaya Lakshmi Pandit, who was the sister of Jawaharlal Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India and one of the greatest political figures of the 20th century, a champion of the whole decolonization movement that characterized the second half of the 20th century. And when I sat down at the table with Mrs. Pandit, who had been Indian ambassador in Moscow, at the UN in New York, and in London, and had been accredited to Ireland, in fact, from London in those days, she said to me, "Oh, you're Irish." And I said, "Yes, I am." And she said, she recited this poem, "When You Were Old. When you were old and grey and full of sleep and nodding by the fire, take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes had once and of their shadows deep. How many loved your moments of glad grace and loved your beauty with a love false or true? But one man loved the pilgrim soul in you and loved the sorrows of your changing face. And bending down beside the glowing bars, whisper a little sadly how love fled and paced upon the mountains overhead and hid his face amid a crowd of stars." And you know, as Mrs. Pandit recited that poem by heart, her whole family who were around the table, children and grandchildren, joined in. They all knew this poem by Yeats. I asked Mrs. Pandit where she'd learned the poem. She said, "I learned it when I was interned by the British in the 1930s with my brother, when we were bidding for Indian independence. And we saw Ireland as an inspiration for our struggle for independence. And we saw Yeats as a poet that we could revere because of his nationalist outlook." So that left me with a permanent impression of the importance of Irish literature to Ireland, which goes beyond the mere value of Yeats's work as literature. It also, I think, relates to the value of Yeats's work to Ireland and as an insight, as a window into Irish history.
It had to be an extraordinary experience, I think, to have Yeats quoted back to you a long way from Ireland.
She went on to quote Lake Galloway Inis Free as well, and like word perfect. In fact, at that time, I didn't know those poems by heart, but I made sure to learn them afterwards because I felt if this great Indian family knows these poems, I, as a young Irish diplomat, should certainly do likewise, make the effort.
So I'd like to explore, just pick up the thread before your lovely recitation, about that pivotal time in Irish history, which we now, in recent years, have referred to as the decade of centenaries. Is Yeats Yeats without that decade? He seems to me to be totally remade from a guy that's essentially writing beautiful, lyrical, Celtic mist-type poetry to something totally different.
Yeah, absolutely correct. In fact, that'll be the thesis that runs through my book, that Yeats helped to make Ireland, and Ireland made Yeats, because I think that there was something about the Ireland at that time which was conducive to the kind of writing that Yeats was capable of producing. And the amazing thing about Yeats is that his poetry evolved all through his life. And he's probably the only poet in the English language who was a great poet before the First World War and after the First World War. So in other words, and I think Richard Ellman, who was the great Yeats and Joyce scholar, wrote an obituary of Mrs. Yeats when she died in the 1960s, actually. And he said, he made the point that had Yeats died in 1917, instead of marrying the then Georgie Hyde-Lees, George Yeats, as she became, he would have been regarded as a significant lyric poet with a significant gift for lyric poetry, but without much to say for himself. And that's probably true, in that the poetry that we love of Yeats and that people tend to put into their list of favorite poems is all very imaginative, but not particularly weighty. Whereas the poems that Yeats wrote in the 1920s and 30s were very weighty. And again, thinking about Yeats's Nobel Prize, most Nobel Prize winners probably win the prize and then take a long bow as globally famous writers. Yeats produced probably his best work after, in the 16 years after he received the Nobel Prize. And I think what kept Yeats going was his engagement, his troubled engagement with Ireland. Had Ireland been a perfect creation, I don't think Yeats's poetry would have been much to write home about. It was the fact that that Ireland both inspired him, frustrated him, bewildered him, and angered him. And yet he never lost his interest in the country. It's that combination that I believe makes Yeats the great Irish poet that I believe he is.
I think there will be much to continue to debate about Yeats, the enigma that he is. But unfortunately, our time is drawing to a close, and I could ask another dozen questions quite comfortably. But I'm going to give you the platform and tell me what's next for Dan Mulhall.
Yeah, I'm currently thinking about another project. I am the patron of the Thomas Francis Marr Society in Waterford, where I come from. And I was there last year for his 200th birthday. You don't get invited to 200 birthday parties very often. You probably know that. And then I was also there for the 175th anniversary of the first flying of the Irish flag by Marr in Waterford. And I've also been to Helena in Montana, where you have an amazing equestrian statue of Marr. Plus, I've been to all the Civil War battlefields where Marr fought in the 1860s. So I'm tempted by the idea of doing something on Marr because of my Waterford background and because I think the Young Ireland movement may not have gotten the kind of credit that it deserves. And of course, a lot of the members of the Young Ireland movement ended up in America, as it happens. They were a significant exile group, and some of them then became Fenians afterwards and influenced the subsequent course of Irish history. So I'm thinking about looking at Marr. I'm also tempted to delve more into the story of Charles Stuart Parnell, because what really fascinates me about Parnell is how this rather remote figure with no obvious charisma about him managed to become the uncrowned King of Ireland in the 1880s before he fell from grace. And also how he managed to become the focus of significant attention for two major writers, Yeats and Joyce. I can't think of any other politician in the annals of modern history that was written about by two major writers of the quality of Yeats and Joyce. So I'm interested in maybe delving into that particular story as well. And also, I've got this idea. When I was at NYU, I taught this course called Literature as History, Ireland, 1880 to 1940, using Yeats, Joyce, O'Casey, Synge, and others to illustrate the history of Ireland in that crucial period between 1880, when Parnell came into his own, and 1940, when Ireland became a neutral country during the great cataclysm of the Second World War. So those are three projects that I have on my agenda to look into. I'm not sure which of those projects I will actually pursue, but I'm going to look at all of them and see what I can come up with and which of them will attract me to spend my time poring over old books and typing at my screen over the next year and a half or so. What I am confident about now is that I can produce books that people want to read without spending 10 years on it. I don't have 10 years to spend on anything at this stage. If I do a book again, it'll be a one-year project because I just don't like the idea. I mean, poor old Robert Caro, who's been working on the biography of Lyndon Johnson for about 30 years and is now on volume 5. That's not my kind of history. I like to write for people who are regular readers who want to know more about a subject and don't necessarily want to delve too deeply into the depths of scholarship that surround writers like Yeats and Joyce. My work is more for people who have a general interest in the subject, but are not academically inclined. And I hope that I found an audience of people. I certainly get a lot of positive feedback from readers who have enjoyed my book. And that's, of course, the only thing that writers ever want is that their readers will enjoy what they have to say for themselves.
I'm delighted to hear that you're going to continue to be busy. And I can personally say I've enjoyed both your books and Joyce and Yeats. It certainly enriched my lives. And I would recommend both to our listeners. The latest book is Pilgrim Soul, W.B. Yeats and the Ireland of His Time. It's published by New Island Books. It is available in Ireland and America. And we look forward to having the opportunity to hear about the next production when it comes to fruition. And on behalf of our...
Watch this space.
Absolutely.
In fact, I am also involved, by the way, in a book that's coming out this year on Irish America. I think you should really do a podcast on that, maybe with a couple of the people who've contributed to the book. It's edited by two American-based academics, and I've contributed an afterword to the book, which I'm very happy about. And I think the book is a very good addition to our knowledge of Irish America.
I will take that on board, and I think that sounds like a great idea. So with that, a big thank you to Damiel Hall. I've enjoyed this conversation immensely. I'm sure our listeners will also enjoy and get the book. It's time well spent.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. For those that have an interest in Ireland's literary history, I strongly recommend both of Dan's books on Joyce and now Yeats. They are thoughtful, approachable, and deliver great insights into two of Ireland's major literary figures, while also revealing the impact both writers had on one of Ireland's premier diplomats. With this episode, Irish Stew's fifth season draws to a close. We started back in March of last year and recorded 22 episodes. We hope our work has helped enrich your life in some small way and contributed a deeper understanding of Ireland and some of the extraordinary people who are tied to that small island off the west coast of Europe. We'll be back again in March with a new season featuring more great conversations, and we hope something totally new. So stay tuned. This is Martin Nutty, and you've been listening to the Irish Stew Podcast. Irish Stew is produced by John Lee, Martin Nutty, and Bill Schultz. Editing, mixing, and mastering by Bill Schultz. Music on Irish Stew was composed and performed by Rosa Nutty, with Donald Bowens on drums, Cathal O'Riordan on bass and synthesizer. For more on Rosa Nutty's music, please visit rosanutty.com.